Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Maria Hamilton, Dontre Hamilton's mother, is the main organizer and will lead a Mother's Day march that will take place this Sunday in Washington, D.C. She and other mothers whose children have been harmed, killed by police will be meeting, she just told us, with people in the White House on Friday of this week. Her goal is to have the Justice Department reopen police shooting cases around the country. She is the founder of Mothers for Justice United. And in case you are not familiar with her story, let me briefly tell it to you. She'll tell it in much more detail during this hour. 31-year-old Dontre Hamilton, her son, was killed by a police officer on April 30th, 2014, in Red Arrow Park in Milwaukee. He suffered from mental illness. Officer Christopher Manny shot Hamilton after responding to a call of a man sleeping in the park. Two other officers had been to the park before Manny and found that he was doing nothing wrong. Manny roused Dontre, tried to pat him down, which was the wrong police procedure. And according to Manny's account, Dontre took his baton and hit him with it. Manny shot Hamilton 14 times. There are elements of race in all of these stories. Dontre was black and Manny was white. Alicia Stingley is also with us in a studio, and she will be going to Washington this weekend as well with members of her family. She is the mother of Corey Stingley. And this is another very disturbing story. On the story of Corey is that he was involved in going to a convenience store in West Allis, Wisconsin, a couple of years ago, and he evidently was engaged in a minor shoplifting incident, and he was grabbed by three white guys who were in this convenience store and held down as he was giving back what he had taken and had a debit card. He was reaching for the card, and these three guys held him and essentially suffocated him, and he died. He was a student, 16 years old, talented athlete, good student at Nathan Hale High School, the youngest of four children. And his mom is with us in our studio today as well, Alicia Stingley. She is the mother of Corey Stingley, and she will be marching this Sunday along with other people in her family. Thank you both very much for being with us. It's the march is Saturday. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm thinking Sunday is Mother's Day. Saturday is the march. I'm thinking about what a Mother's Day weekend this is going to be for both of you, and how hard I'm the mom of boys too, and I just can't imagine that it gets much easier at any time in your life. But you, Maria, have really rallied people all around the country. It has stirred you to a kind of action that you wish you didn't have to take in your life, but have you ever taken action here? You just have meetings at the White House. You have a demand for justice.
Yes. Yes. Dontre, spirit was so bright and full of life. And meeting these moms and doing the research on the deaths of their loved ones brought me to this place that I'm at. I asked God what was it he wanted me to do in being able to grieve for Dontre, and he told me to move. At that point, I didn't know what move was, but after I started going to the rallies, I met Corey Stingley's dad, Craig, and he was just so in tune to getting the message across that he wasn't going to stop. He was going to continue to fight for his son. And so many doors had been shut in his face. I could see the pain and the anguish from people just totally disrespecting him. After meeting him, and me and my family got involved with the fight for justice, we got treated the same way. No respect, no empathy, no compassion for life. And I just got to the point that I wanted to run away and just crawl up under a rock. But I fell to my knees and I asked God to use me to get the justice that's deserved for all these families, not only Dontray.
You called for this march from a church in Ferguson, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And I also went to Rainbow Push in Chicago and did a call to action over 50 countries.
How many people and who are some of the people who will be joining you on Saturday?
I have mass organization Mothers Against Senseless Killings joining me. I have Juanita Young from New York, Mothers Cry joining me. I have Black Lives Matter from New York joining me. I have Jordan Baker's mom from Houston, Texas joining me. We're anticipating picking up Tamir Rice, mother in Youngstown, to go to Washington with us. I have Deborah Jenkins here from Milwaukee joining me on behalf of her son, Larry. I have Sonia Moore going with me, who is the mother of Derek that was killed in the back of a police car, begging for his life. I have Alicia Stingley going with me. Corey is her son. I have Alicia Johnson going with me. Brandon Johnson was her son. He walked into a mental facility with the police officer and never walked back out. It's amazing at this point. The strength that these mothers have gained to have their voices and their stories told.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, tell us more about what's happened with Corey and your attempt to get justice for Corey. There was really a very strong element, from my reading of this, of race in this case. Corey was a student. He was a good student. He was an athlete. He'd been in that store many times before. Can you refresh our memories of that story and what's happened with your pleas for justice since then, how far you've taken this in the criminal justice field, and if you've gotten any response?
Sure. Well, yeah, as you mentioned, Corey was a 16-year-old student at Nathan Hale High School. He was a sophomore, very gifted athlete, very well-liked student, very bright. He was actually suspended that day that he was attacked, and that's why he was able to even be in the store during the middle of the day. And ironically enough, that situation was racially motivated.
Really?
Yeah, he was in his advanced placement government and civics class, and they were talking about how a lot of blacks, especially in the South, aren't able to vote because they're felons. And one of the white students said, well, Corey, that's going to be you one day. And Corey said, don't say one more thing to me. So the guy wisely was quiet. But then after class, he approached Corey again and said something to the effect of, well, no, that's probably already you. Mm. So Corey, being an athlete, a wrestler, he held the boy. And another one of the other guy's friends jumped on Corey's back. And then it was immediately broken up. But then Corey was suspended and the other boys weren't. Hmm. And that really woke up his eyes, because he had always told us up until that point, they don't see race. They're all my friends. All my friends are white. It doesn't matter to them. I'm just one of them. And that really shook him a little bit. And he also had a copy of the Constitution in his pocket. He
really?
Kept it. Yes.
Really?
He was reading it. That's how much of a scholar, and he wanted to know his rights and so forth. And so that day, you know, whatever was going through his mind and in his heart, he was troubled. And he went to the store, this convenience store that he had gone to many, many times, just a few blocks from home. The clerk, the owners knew his dad and everything. So, yes, Corey was attempting to shoplift, and the clerk saw what he put in his bag through the surveillance
right.
cameras. So Corey also went up to the counter to purchase something else. And so he gave the clerk his debit card. And then the clerk said, I saw that you were trying to steal. I saw what you put in your bag. give me the stuff back. I won't call the police, but just don't come in the store anymore. And like I said, he knew his dad, so he would, you know, be able to enforce that. So Corey put the bag on the counter. You could see all of this in the video. The guy took his merchandise out of the bag. Corey grabbed his debit card to leave, to run. And there were three customers in the store that then held him until police came, which was about 10 minutes, and one held him in a chokehold around his neck that entire time. Mm-hmm. So as the story goes, he was wrestling at one point, and then he stopped. And then the guy's response is that they thought he was playing possum. Right? Not a clue that, okay, the young boy is, you know, right. He's hurt. And so by the time the police came, he wasn't able to breathe. You know, heart stopped. They got his heart going. But then he wound up being on a respirator for about 2 weeks. Mm. And at that time, you know, they told us he was pretty much brain dead. And, you know, we all decided as a family that it was best to take him off of the life support, that, you know, he wouldn't, as lively and as energetic as he was, he wouldn't want to live like that. Right. So we took him off the life support. And it took a year for the district attorney to decide that he wasn't going to press charges because you couldn't prove intent. And they also couldn't prove that a reasonable person should know that what they were doing would cause bodily harm, injury, or death. Mm. Right. So that's why they didn't press charges. And so, as Maria mentioned, you know, Corey's dad, Craig, has been very active, very vocal with the district attorney, the Department of Justice. And we just haven't seen, you know, any justice.
Are you going to do a civil suit?
Yes. Yes, that's in the works right now.
But all of that takes time.
Right.
And some of those questions that were just so much just haunt you of three guys, why in the world holding him down, not realizing what they were doing to him? Why didn't they just block the door?
Exactly. Hold his arm and his legs or something like that, right? And these are grown men, 40, 50, you know, grown men. So you would think they would know better. But so at this point, I don't know anything about, you know, whether or not justice is going to be done, if they're going to reopen the case. I certainly hope they will. But I definitely think laws need to be changed in some way, because if the reason they weren't charged is because, you know, a reasonable person, or you can't, you know, basically the district attorney said he doesn't think he could win the case. And if he didn't think he could win the case, he wouldn't even try it. He wouldn't pursue it.
You have to put, because we live in the most segregated community in the country, an element of race in this, which some people won't want to do. But Corey was black and the three guys who held him down were white. Do you put an element of race in here? Does it play in some way?
You know, I do, only because I can think, if that was a white boy, would they have done that? If Corey was in a black neighborhood, would that have happened? No. They would have let him go, or like you said, they might have held him, maybe not, or they might have just said, you know, if Corey was a white boy, we know his dad or whatever, who knows.
But or I don't, if he was a white boy held down by three black African-Americans,
totally different.
They'd be under the jail, right?
Right.
And I think, though, a lot of it, even with Dontre, it's that fear. You know, they have a fear, it seems like, of black men. And, you know, like with Dontre, you know, he's so strong and look like he's, you know, evil. And that's the same type of thing with Corey. He's strong. So they're strong, so you got to kill him.
Right.
And then that's okay. You know what I mean?
Right.
That just,
right.
And
right.
I do think there's an element of race, too, because, you know, again, we don't know anybody's intention, but You do have to truly wonder.
Well, you have to ask the question here. You just have to.
Yeah.
And Dontre was sleeping on a bench in Red Arrow Park. He was sleeping.
Well, actually, Dontre wasn't asleep, and Dontre wasn't on a bench.
Oh, he wasn't?
Dontre was on the concrete ground right in front of the Red Arrow statue. That was something Dontre did in my house. He would sit on the floor with his back up against my bed and shake his leg. It wasn't rapid like they portrayed it to be. I do it. several people in my family, we sit and we rock our leg and watching TV or maybe listening to music. It's just something that we just generally do, you know. I do it so much that I don't even realize I'm doing it sometimes. Dontre was waiting for his brother. I know that he wouldn't have went to sleep outside in a park. When he talked in 15 minutes prior to Christopher Manning murdering him, he told him, "I'm just chilling in the park." It's really ironic that we've been a family that always barbecued and went to the park, and my children and grandchildren now swing on swings, the seesaw. This is something normal that he actually did by going to the park. Dontre used to sell water to the basketball players. He used to take candy and chips. He just happened to be in the downtown area because he was in crisis during that time, and he didn't want to be at home. His electricity wasn't working in his bedroom, so he didn't want to just sit in the dark. So he actually walked from 20th and Center all the way downtown with me on the phone until he got to the Hampton Inn. Dontre had spent the night at the Hampton Inn. He paid $136 for his room. When he woke up that morning, he called me and told me that he felt like he was going to be killed if he left the Hampton Inn. I was like, "Oh, Dontre, ain't nobody going to do nothing to you. Me and Sonny going to pick you up. We're going to go and have some lunch, and then I'll take you out on Waterplank Road to see if I could get you your shot." And he was like, "Okay."
The shot for what? You tell us about his mental illness.
Dontre was diagnosed with paranoia schizophrenic in March of 2013. I believe that it actually started manifesting after his 5-week-old son died from SIDS death. We actually met his son at Northwestern Funeral Home. The mom wasn't able to bury the baby, and she didn't even tell Dontre that she had had him because they wasn't on speaking terms. But she did reach out to me to help her bury him because they gave her an ice cart to actually bury him in. So I actually picked Dontre up, and we went to the funeral home. We seen the baby. He looked it just like Dontre, so there was no need for me to do any DNA testing. I wanted him to be buried nicely. You know, I wanted him to have a decent memorial. Dontre is actually buried 100 feet away from his baby at Graceland Cemetery. I don't understand Christopher Manning or these police officers that we pay to protect and serve us. If there was any kind of concern that he had any kind of health issues or mental issues, if she had walked out of that trailer and said something to Dontre, with his personality and his spirit, he would have been like, "No, ma'am, I'm fine. I'm waiting on my brother."
Right.
Her calling the police started a chain of effects that none of us will ever get over in the city of Milwaukee. It changed the way we live. It changed our environment. It changed how we look at people, because nobody is born with race. That's something that was molded and instilled in them. You don't have that when you come out of your mom's womb. So to have that amount of hate for any human life is humane to me.
And there was a good amount of hate involved in both of the instances that we're talking about, wasn't there?
Right.
You, the other stories that were prominent is that the police department seems to not have the kind of training that it needs to deal with people who are mentally ill. And obviously there are people who are mentally ill who are on the streets all over the city of Milwaukee. Did you find that at least that part of this story gave you some hope that there will be training of officers to determine, which they should have known, how to deal with somebody who had mental illness?
Well, the way they had the CIT training up is crisis intervention training. They only had about 15 or 20 minutes that actually dealt with them dealing with mental illness. I think where the ball is actually dropped with mental illness, they need to have somebody that is actually trained and prepared to go out to these calls with the police to de-escalate a situation before the police has pulled their guns. Not only do they see black men as being strong, superhuman people, they have that fear in them that all black men are criminal and are a suspect of something, whether they've ever been in a system or not. They just, yeah. They get out their car and, oh, okay, he's black. He had to been doing something wrong. And that's not the truth. Because we have hope and values, and we love our families, and we love our family members, just like white people, Mexican people, Puerto Rican people. We love our families. But the fact that we're in poverty-stricken neighborhoods has a lot to do with it also, because the way the system is in Milwaukee, it wasn't made for me and my family to actually survive in and get ahead. It's to keep us bound. And it's wrong for any human life to be bound and have to struggle to provide for your families. That they talk about black-on-black crime here in Milwaukee. If people had jobs in their neighborhood, if they had decent homes, if they were able to feed their families and dress their families, it wouldn't be that much black-on-black crime. We would need the police presence in our neighborhoods the way that they are.
What would both of you, if you could just sort of dream for a minute and take this to all levels that you want to take it to, if you're looking for justice so that your families can have, you'll never have a lot of peace over this in your whole lifetimes. It'll be horrible, I'm sure. But just to answer questions or to have justice served. And then on a larger level, you've hinted at some of it, Maria, what it is that we need to learn from all of this as a society. Are we dealing with these horrendous issues of race where we're seeing African Americans as less than human in some way? Is that the basis behind these many cases? Do we need to work on that? How do we do that? How many levels are we talking about? Start with yourselves, what would give you some peace, and then take it to everybody.
I think what would give me some peace in our situation would be just some type of retribution, some type of restitution. It's hard to imagine that, you know, when you're a mother and you lose a child, and you lose that child to violence, and you lose that child to violence and it's at the hands of somebody white, and then you don't get any type of justice. It's like, you know, just a knife twisting in your heart. So you want some kind of restitution, somebody to say, this was wrong. What happened was wrong. But when the criminals aren't even tried, it's almost like it's not even a slap on the wrist. What right. did they get? Nothing. They don't get a fine. They don't get probation. I mean, absolutely nothing. So some type of balance, you know, needs to be restored, because we'll always be off balance. And I think the way to help that is, like you mentioned, you know, Milwaukee is the most segregated, you know, city in the country, you know, meaning we have so many of the black people in this one little area, and everybody else is around. So when, you know, the majority come into our areas, they are fearful. So we need to have dialogue. We do need to have training. And I don't think just because, you know, a police officer has a badge that they're not criminals. Anybody that takes somebody's life, you know, and especially in a violent manner, something needs to be done about that. That's what I think on a larger scale, that we need to say all lives matter. But it just so happens that it's so many cases where it's these young black men that are being killed, where, you know, they got their hands up, they're running, they're surrendering, whatever it is, and they're still getting killed. We need to educate our kids, right, in some way, but don't run, be still. I don't know what, you know, the onus is on us to do something. But then as a whole, the country needs to say, you know, what can we do? How are we failing, you know, these families? How are we failing our young black boys? How are we failing our disenfranchised, our poor people? How are we failing them? And what can we do? How can we all come together? And I think it starts in the home, you know, because a lot of that can't be legislated. We can't have a law that says I'm not going to be a racist, you know. So a lot of that, it just needs to start in the home. It needs to start in the heart. And a lot of that, I think, too, comes from, you know, some type of faith or a deeper relationship with God.
Very well said. Maria, well, how do you answer that?
I believe with our leaders, they need to set boundaries for the police officers across the board, for all the police officers. You can't live in Chicago and go to prison for a damn bag of weed for 15 years, and then you have my neighbors selling it and making a profit off of it and getting rich. So we need to have them set boundaries. If weed is going to be legal for white privileged people, it need to be legal for these black kids that don't have shoes, that can't feed their kids, whose fathers is being locked up for no reason at all, whose moms are being raped and humiliated out on the public streets by people that are supposed to be protecting and saving us. But what they say is, yeah, it starts in the house, but if you don't have anything in your home to give your children values and goals, what do you do? Because mom can't go to work because we don't have transportation, because there's no jobs in the city for us to work. And if there is, they're under minimum wage. Yeah. And I can't raise my family on minimum wage. So where do we go? Who do we talk to? Put programs back out here. If a parent need help, my mom was a police officer. My mom was a nurse. She used to leave one job and go to another one. Me and my brothers and sisters went home, and we took care of each other in the home. Mm-hmm. But we had values and goals in place. And my mother already knew that she didn't have to worry about us, because we took care of each other. We took care of our neighbors. We helped feed children that didn't have shoes and clothing and stuff like that in our neighborhood. We provided for the people that were surrounded us. We were surrounded by. But you can't do that here because Betty don't have this. Jaquan don't have nothing to eat, so I'm going to take what Betty got because I'm hungry. Mm-hmm. That's just like the young man, 16 years old, that shot that woman in her head because he tired of walking. They don't have anything to hold on to.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests, and here's how you reach this conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The Million Moms March will be taking place the day before Mother's Day this Saturday, organized by Maria Hamilton, mother of Dontre Hamilton. Alicia Stingley, mother of Corey Stingley, are with us in our studios here in Milwaukee, and she will be on the march as well. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we welcome your comments always, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls. Let's start with Sarah in Lafarge. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I, first of all, I just want to express my deep sorrow for both of these ladies with losing their children in such horrible ways I can't even, don't even want to imagine. I am a middle-aged white woman. I have two children, a boy and a girl, that I love and I'm very proud of. I consider myself an ally. I marched in Madison recently. The National Day of Action stood outside the governor's house calling for change on all fronts. And I just wanted to sort of reiterate and back up the point that from my point of view, I struggle with knowing what to do to make a change because, you know, I often feel like my what I do doesn't matter. But then I look at my kids and I realize that I do have a responsibility that starts in my home. I have a responsibility as a mother of a young white boy to raise him to know that all lives do matter, that black lives do matter, and that there is inequality in our system that is rampant. And I just want to praise you ladies for having the courage to speak up, to initiate these talks and these changes, and to just let you know that there are people out here who are behind you, who are speaking your stories, and who are trying in our daily lives to make the changes that matter.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Maria? I appreciate you. It's important that we continue to keep making this problem awareness about it, because I meet people every day and they don't know Dontre's story, but they know of white kids that are being killed by the police also. It's a problem for me because human life matters. So anything that you could do to keep putting the word out that there's a problem and we're dead set on fixing this problem, but it takes all of us.
That's right.
How do you fix it, Alicia?
The caller made a good point in that it starts in the home. And it starts, too, with getting the word out there, with all of us coming together, with there being solidarity, especially from the majority, because if it's just the minority out there, you know, speaking and rallying and marching, our voices aren't necessarily heard. So we really do appreciate when, you know, people in the minority can, you know, come alongside and fight with us. Unfortunately, a lot of times it is a fight, and that's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Jolene in Milwaukee. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, it's Joellen.
Oh, Joellen. Hi, Joellen. I'm sorry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to say to the moms that you're speaking with, I want them to know how much respect and honor I have for the work that they're doing. I'm not sure if I lost a child in such a terrible, violent way, if I would have the courage or the strength to do what they're doing and take this message to people that is so important to be heard. But I also want to say to Mrs. Hamilton what deep respect I have for your son, Nate, to watch him carry himself with grace, to tell a story with such dignity night after night. When every single time I see him on the news, I'm in awe of his grace and his ability to articulate something so painful and powerful that needs to be heard. So pass that along to your son. He's a remarkable man.
Mm-hmm. All right, I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you have been, this has been long for you and for your family. You have been incredible in terms of staying on this, focusing, pressuring people, calling people to accountability, organizing other mothers, getting meetings at the White House, for heaven's sake. I mean, Joellen makes an interesting point that many of us think that we would just want to curl up and not see the light of another day. But you've turned all of this into something that is very important.
Yeah, it's very important. I think it's been swept up on the carpet long enough, and this conversation needs to be talked about. Me taking these moms to have their cases reopened, it means the world to me because they are looking into Dontre's case, and I am so happy that the federal government stepped up and didn't allow the state to do it, because we would be waiting for years. And no mom, nobody should have to feel the pain that we feel anymore. And if they can do something in Washington, D.C., to get us some kind of answers that they are willing to do something, I'll be there every year.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Jordan. Hi, Jordan.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just want to comment and definitely appreciate the perspective of the ladies on the air with you. But it seems like in the past we've kind of lumped all these cases into one kind of common thread of discussion topic. And I guess my question is these are all individual complex cases that had an officer and a young man involved. And I mean, I guess my question to the ladies would be, when do you feel it's justified for a police officer to use force?
Alicia?
I believe it's justified for anybody to use force if they feel their lives are in danger and there's no other option. I don't see why or how a police officer has the need to pull out a gun when the other person doesn't have a gun necessarily. I mean, they do have tasers. They should be trained on how to disarm somebody or to take somebody down or whatever the case may be. But I don't think they should, you know, their first or even second course of action should be to pull out a gun. And then obviously when people are down on the ground, when they're running away, why are we shooting them in the back? Why are we shooting them when they're on the ground? Why are we shooting them when their hands are up? That's not justified.
Yeah. Maria?
For me, I remember my mom telling us a lot of stories because she was a police officer. They actually had officers that went out to these calls to de-escalate a situation before a gun was pulled. They no longer have these particular captains and sergeants that go and de-escalate. A lot of lives would be saved if the police wasn't afraid. If there is something going on mentally and emotionally with you, if you see a 5'7" black man that weighs 140 pounds and your life is threatened, you need to go to another job. You shouldn't be out on the street if you're afraid for your life. If a teenage child that's 39 years old is running out of a store and you got to choke him to death.
Yeah. Did your mom talk about issues of race, issues of police officers understanding what was taking place on the street when she was in the force?
No, we were always told that the police was our friend. He was Mr. Friendly.
Yeah.
We had police officers that would pull up and give us ice cream. They would come and take their guns and their belt off and play kickball with us and go to the parks with us and play baseball while they were on the clock. I ended up losing my dog and was afraid to go home, and they actually stayed with me until my dog was returned. So no, we didn't have to tell our kids, well, if you see a police drive by, don't make eye contact, don't run, don't try to act like you're scared or afraid or anything to make them feel suspicious of you.
Yeah. Alicia, you have other children. You have three other children, is that right?
That's correct.
Tell me how they're dealing with all of this and how old they are.
My oldest is 23. Just to say, when this happened, they were all in school. It was in December. It was around exam time, so they all just didn't do well that whole school year.
Sure.
So the whole next semester was just kind of a wash for all of them. My oldest son has since become a missionary.
Really?
Yeah. So he's, yeah, so, awesome, right? Mm-hmm. And my middle daughter, she's turning to art. She writes poetry. She takes pictures. She makes buttons and just all types of art. And that's her means of protesting, so to speak, or working it out. She's very gifted that way. My youngest daughter, they all really struggled for a time. And my youngest daughter is still in school at UWM, and she's using her grief in a creative way. She's in their creative, or will be in their creative directing program, where she'll be able to do, like, for movies or plays, do props and lighting and makeup and sound and that sort of thing. So they're all kind of doing things in their own way. My oldest son, he's a missionary right now to college students, and part of what he's doing is having them have dialogue, have talks, and realizing that's an important way for them to kind of break the ice and his way to kind of honor his brother and things like that. And they do a lot of art around their brother and their poetry, and they've done paintings of their brothers, just so many different things. And that's how they're dealing with it. We're all kind of turning a corner. It's been a couple of years, so it's not that it's easier, but we're all healing.
Yeah, Maria, your other children. They become activists, actually. You got quite a family.
Yeah. Nate is a powerful activist. I feel as though Nate was chosen. He was involved in a church ministry, and he kind of shied away from it because he felt as though he wasn't talking to enough people. There wasn't enough people actually getting the dialogue that he was actually given. So when Dontre died and he wasn't able to pick Dontre up before this horrific incident happened, he has decided that every morning that he gets up, he's going to get Dontre by helping somebody, by getting the word out, or providing a safe haven for another child or a young man who is lost and not able to provide for his family. The mentoring that the coalition is doing is amazing. We're building. He wants to build, and there's no stopping for Nate. Damien is more of a subdued type person. Damien works long hours. He has three daughters. He works with music. Damien's been writing music since he was 9 or 10 years old. So that's his way of actually giving back to the community. He's been writing poetry since Dontre died. He had a vision, and the name of the poem is "Tell Mama Don't Cry." But since he wrote that, I've seen the change in them as men. I see them gravitating more towards the community that we live in. They're amazing. They're amazing.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to a few more phone calls for our guest. Bill in Wakefield is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to give a great shout-out to Keep the Faith here. We're up in the Upper Peninsula, Wakefield, and it's a highly white community. I've encountered a lot of African Americans working down south in Atlanta and the Carolinas, and like Martin Luther King kind of said briefly, I have a dream that one day whites and African American will be as one, and justice will be served. And just wanted to say we're there with you with our prayers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Bill. I appreciate it.
And do you share that belief that one day justice will be served, or do you feel like it's a pipe dream?
No, I really feel like Dontre, Corey, Derek, all the young lives that were stolen from us. It's for change. I feel as though they were sacrificed to get this work done. I feel as though their human lives were seeds that was planted. So God could allow us to start doing this work.
Yeah, I feel the same way, you know, that Corey, his life had a purpose and his death had a purpose. And I think, you know, it's not the end of it. And I truly do believe that things will change. And if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Romello in Appleton, hi.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to tell both mothers I'm sorry for their loss.
Thank you.
And I would also like to say I was born and raised. I grew up in New Orleans in Louisiana. And by the age of 17, I had already been shot twice. Mm-hmm. First time, three times in the back. Mm-hmm. Second time, once in the arm. And it got to the point in my life that it didn't bother me. I mean, I kind of, mm-hmm. in a weird way, and at that age, I know it's kind of hard to say, but I wanted to die for, I don't know, I just blamed the world for everything. It didn't matter to me if I lived or died. Mm-hmm. To me, it was all about getting money. But I would like to say that with all the publicity right now with the officers, it was a white officer in New Orleans that changed my life. The last time I was shot, he went out of his way after I got out. I had every intention once I got out of hospital going back to what I was doing, making money the same way, whatever. I didn't care. The white officer actually met me at the hospital with my mother, took me to his family business and got me a job.
Oh, my goodness.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said that he saw something in me and he knew that I was going to end up dead on the streets. Took him to his family business and got me a job.
Why were you shot? Romello, why were you shot?
It was all over drugs. But yeah, the second time he took me to the hospital, he took me to his family's business and got me a job, checked in on me from time to time. And to this day, I'm 39 years old now and he's retired. And to this day, not a month that goes by that I don't call him, or he calls me to see how things are going. And I honestly believe if he wouldn't have done that for me, and I'm still working to this day, I have not went back to that lifestyle. But I do believe he never done that for me, that I would be under the ground right now.
Yeah.
And you know something, I applaud you for your efforts and that police officer. I believe that not all police officers are bad.
Of course not.
Yeah. I actually was embraced Monday when I went to go and pick up my brace, my grant for the Million Moms March, by a police that told me to try to stay strong. There are some good cops, but they need some work. They need some help. He told me that it's going to take more than 5 police officers out of 1,500 to actually get the change that's needed in the system that they work in. It's hard for them to get out. And I get it, because my mom was a police officer, and it was stuff going on. She didn't discuss it with us, but we knew it was there, you know. It's a lot of jobs where you have bad people doing bad things, but they're not getting paid for it, okay? If I end up stealing something from my job and there's an investigation, I'm not going to get paid while they're investigating me before I'm terminated, you know? So we just have to continue to keep pushing them to make the changes. Since Dontre was murdered here, after Tony was murdered, after the killing in Kenosha, Milwaukee police officers know that we're watching. People have to stop keeping it in to themselves like it don't affect them, because it could be anybody's family. It's not just black. Right now, it's not a color thing. They have that power and that control behind that badge, and they have been protected and not held accountable. Yeah. So it's not a color thing for me. It's all officers.
The world needs a whole lot more human kindness. Oh, my gosh. Thank you both so much for being with us. Happy Mother's Day to you.
Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. And let us know how the march goes, and we'll talk to you again. We'd love to have you on again after you return.
Okay. Thanks for having us.
Months go on. Thank you. Our thanks to Maria Hamilton. She organized the Mother's Day march, which takes place on Saturday of this week, and they're going to be meeting with people in the White House on Friday of this week. And thanks to Alicia Stingley, Maria, mother of Dontre Hamilton, of course, and Alicia, the mother of Corey Stingley. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this program, and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow.